Welcome to Udemy Research from our Building a Micro School series by Valor Engels.
Today we are doing a really critical deep dive. We're looking at the operational realities, the financial constraints, and really the evidence base for starting and running a micro school for that kindergarten age group.
So 4 and 5 year olds.
Exactly.
And we really need to set the stage here with just the scale and the risk involved. I mean, this is not some fringe movement anymore.
Not at all.
We're talking about a huge shift in education. The estimate suggests somewhere between 750,000 and, what, maybe 2 million children are in micro schools or learning pods right now in the U.S.
Yeah, and parents are flocking to them for a very clear reason. They are reacting against that sort of factory model classroom. They want small groups. They want personalization.
Right. They want something tailored to their actual kid.
But that leads to this massive, and I mean massive, core dilemma that we have to confront right at the top. Parents are pouring their trust, their time, their money into this sector, but there is virtually zero rigorous, large-scale research specifically on microschool outcomes.
Zero.
We just don't have the data yet to say that a privately run, unaccredited small group is definitively better in the long run than, say, a traditional public school.
And this isn't just, you know, the usual lag in research. The RAND Corporation actually tried to study this.
They did, and their findings were pretty stark.
They concluded that their researchers could identify fewer than 0.1% of microschools for analysis using traditional methods.
Right, because the very thing parents love, the flexibility, the independence, it makes them almost invisible to scientific study.
So our mission today is to confront that gap, but to do it with, you know, intellectual honesty.
Yes. Since we can't look at direct studies, we're going to synthesize the strong proxy research that does exist.
Okay, so what does that mean, proxy research?
It means decades of large-scale studies on what we know matters in early childhood. Things like small class size, play-based learning, teacher interactions.
The fundamentals.
The fundamentals. We'll take those gold standard findings, and then we're going to apply them to the cold, hard realities that founders face. The money, the regulations, the staffing.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's unpack this with the foundational glossary, because the terms here really, really matter.
They do.
So let's start with the big one. What exactly is a micro school in this context?
So when we talk about a micro school, we're really just talking about a small learning environment. Typically, you're looking at maybe 5 to 15 students.
That's the usual range.
That's the sweet spot.
Yeah.
And they're characterized by, you know, flexible pedagogy. They might blend Montessori with project-based learning. And, crucially, they often operate outside of traditional accreditation systems.
Okay. Next, we have to clarify something that gets mixed up all the time in the research.
Mm.
Adult-child ratio versus class size.
Yeah, this is a really important distinction. The ratio is the total number of adults to the total number of children in the whole program. So a 1-to-8 ratio means one adult for every 8 kids. Class size, though, is just the total number of kids in a single room at one time. And the research shows that once you get to a certain number, just adding another adult doesn't always help as much as you'd think.
Interesting. Okay, now for the most important technical metric we'll probably use today, effect size, measured in standard deviations, or SD.
Right.
Can you explain what that means to someone who hasn't been reading education papers for a living?
Sure. It's basically a way to standardize and measure the impact of something. It's the measurable difference in outcomes, usually test scores, between a group that got the intervention, like a small class, and a control group that didn't.
So it tells us if the change actually worked and by how much.
Exactly. How much of a difference did it make?
Can you make that number tangible for us? Like if we hear a 0.20 standard deviation gain. What does that feel like for a kid?
Okay, so a 0.20 SD gain is statistically meaningful. If you imagine a student who was scoring right at the 50th percentile dead average before the intervention, a 0.20 SD increase means that student would now score at the 58th percentile. They've moved past 8% more of their peers because of that one change.
That's a real jump. It's not huge, but over a few years, I could see how that would compound.
It compounds substantially. It's these small, durable gains that matter early on.
Perfect.
Well,
lastly, let's establish the quality markers we'll be using. Structural quality versus process quality.
This distinction is foundational. Structural quality is all the measurable, countable stuff.
Like the ratio, the teacher's degree, the size of the room.
Exactly. The things you can put on a checklist. Process quality, on the other hand, is about the actual quality of the interactions happening inside that room.
So the warmth, the emotional support, how responsive the teacher is.
The richness of the language, the rigor of the instruction. And as we'll see, the research is pointing more and more towards process quality being the thing that really moves the needle.
And there's a tool to measure the environment, right? ESSERS.
Yes, the Early Childhood Environment Rating Scale. It's a standardized observation tool that looks at everything from room organization to supervision. It tends to correlate pretty well with teacher qualifications.
But not always with student outcomes directly.
Not always directly, and that's a key nuance we'll come back to.
Okay, with those foundations in place, let's dive into why parents are even looking for these models. It all starts with the biological reality of a 4 or 5-year-old brain.
It really does. You have to remember the biology here. By the time a child turns 5, they have done roughly 90% of their total lifetime brain development.
90%. That number is just staggering. It makes these early years feel incredibly high stakes.
They are the ultimate high stakes period. That time between 4 and 5 is this rapid formation phase. The neural circuits for language, for emotion regulation, for social skills, executive function, they're all actively, rapidly forming.
And that formation isn't passive, right? It's not just about downloading information.
No, it's experience dependent. It doesn't happen by sitting still at a desk. It happens through responsive, patterned experiences, through interaction, movement, and social engagement.
Which brings us right back to the core mismatch you mentioned.
Exactly. This active dynamic development is fundamentally mismatched with the factory model classroom.
A model that prioritizes what? Information transfer and compliance.
Right. Standardization.
Yeah.
And it often has to sacrifice that deep interaction that the developing brain is literally crying out for. Micro schools, just by being small, offer a way to fix that mismatch.
Okay, so that's the theory. Let's see if the proxy evidence actually holds up. The biggest piece of evidence for small groups is Tennessee Project STAR.
Project STAR, yes. It was conducted in Tennessee from 1985 to 1989, and its power comes from the fact that it was a randomized controlled trial.
The gold standard. So they actually randomly placed kids into different class sizes.
Exactly. Kindergarten through third grade. They were put in either small classes of 13 to 17 students, regular classes of 22 to 25, or regular classes with a teacher's aide.
And that random assignment is what lets us say it's causal, not just a correlation.
That's the key.
So what were the results? I mean, the measurable long-term results of being in those smaller classes.
They found statistically significant and, importantly, durable effects. Effect sizes of 0.15 to 0.20 standard deviations in math and reading for the small classes.
So that's that jump from the 50th to the 58th percentile we talked about.
Right. And it wasn't just a temporary boost. The positive impact of being in a small class in those early years, it persisted. It influenced things like graduation rates, college application rates down the line.
Wow. But there was an even deeper finding in that data, right? Something about equity.
Yes. And this is so critical for founders who want to serve diverse communities. The data showed that Black students benefited even more.
Not much more.
They saw gains of about 1/3 of a standard deviation, closer to 0.33 SD.
That's huge.
It is. It suggests that this kind of intensive, responsive environment might be a powerful tool for closing achievement gaps really early.
So SAR showed gains going from 25 down to 17. What about the sizes that are more typical for micro schools, like under 15?
For that, we can look at the Bowen meta-analysis. It pulled together findings from lots of different studies, and they found some really critical thresholds.
Okay.
They found the strongest effects happen when you get below a 7.5:1 adult-child ratio.
7.5:1. That is a very high-quality environment, and it's right in the wheelhouse for a lot of micro schools.
Absolutely. The Bowen data showed that for every one-child reduction below that 7.5:1 ratio, you saw a corresponding 0.22 standard deviation increase in outcomes.
That's an incredible finding.
It is. And specifically for class sizes below 15 students, they saw a 0.10 standard deviation gain for each child reduction. So structurally, the microschool model lines up perfectly with what the research says is high impact.
But, and this is the key nuance you brought up earlier, the structure isn't magic. A low ratio is not a guarantee of success.
Correct. The low ratio is an opportunity. It creates the potential for high quality interaction, but it doesn't guarantee it.
So you could have a 5:1 ratio with a totally disengaged teacher.
And you'd get nothing out of it. The meta-analyses confirm it's the process quality, the warmth, the responsiveness, the instructional rigor that matters more than the structural features alone.
Structure creates the potential. Process delivers the outcome.
That's the mantra.
Okay, so let's talk about that process.
Mm-hmm.
How should a teacher in this high-quality environment actually be teaching? Let's talk play versus instruction.
The evidence here is powerful, and it's often really counterintuitive for parents who are worried about their kids falling behind.
Right.
A major meta-analysis found that for kids under 8, guided play is significantly more effective than direct traditional instruction for learning academic content.
Guided play, can you define that?
It means the teacher is strategic. They design the environment, they steer the activity, maybe building a complex block structure, but the child is the one directing the actual execution and exploration.
So where does explicit teaching fit in, or does it?
Oh, it has a very specific and essential role. The research is clear that explicit teaching is beneficial for two foundational skills, alphabet recognition and phonological awareness.
So you still need daily structured phonics.
Absolutely. You cannot leave that to chance.
Yeah.
But for broader concepts, early math, science, social skills, the guided play format is superior.
We hear a lot about the long-term outcomes of play-based programs being better. Is that true?
Yes. There's a fascinating German longitudinal study that compared kids from academic kindergartens to play-based ones. And by grade 3, the kids from the play-based programs were excelling.
Really?
The academic-focused kids often had these initial gains that just faded away. They showed less resilience, poorer problem-solving skills over time.
So the play-based approach teaches them how to learn, not just what to know.
Precisely. Play builds the executive function, curiosity, and persistence you need for all later learning.
This seems like a good place to bring in the Montessori model, which is often held up as this gold standard proxy. Yeah. What did the latest research show?
The Lillard et al. 2025 PNAS randomized controlled trial is a huge deal. It found that certified Montessori preschools produce lasting gains in reading, executive function, and social understanding. When it's done right, it's highly effective.
But you're emphasizing that word, certified.
Absolutely. This is the critical caveat for any microschool founder. The outcomes are tied to trained, certified teachers who are following a rigorous methodology.
It's not just about having the wooden materials.
No. It takes years of intensive training to learn how to guide a child through that prepared environment. Just putting out some blocks and calling it Montessori-inspired does not transfer those results.
Okay, finally, let's tackle the biggest challenge to how we normally think about early education. The teacher credential paradox.
This one challenges everything. A major 2007 analysis by Early and his colleagues looked at 7 huge ECE data sets.
Done.
They found, and I'm quoting here, largely null or contradictory associations between a teacher's education level, like having a BA, and the children's actual academic outcomes.
Wait, hold on. The teacher's credentials don't predict how well the kids will do.
Not directly, no.
So what are the credentials predicting?
They consistently predict higher scores on tools like ESERS, the classroom environment scale.
Ah, so better educated teachers are better at creating a high quality environment, organized, well-stocked, follows the rules.
Exactly. The mechanism is indirect. The degree helps the teacher create the optimal environment where that all-important process quality can happen. But the degree itself doesn't guarantee the warmth or responsiveness that drives learning.
This has huge implications for the micro school world, right? Given who is starting these schools.
Massive implications. Industry data shows 60% or more of micro school founders lack traditional credentials.
So is that a huge risk or a reasonable adaptation?
That's the multi-million dollar question. If you only look at structural quality, it's a giant flashing red light. If you focus on process quality, maybe it's an acceptable adaptation to the terrible economics of ECE wages. But for families, this is the biggest unstudied risk.
Okay, so we've laid out this perfect theoretical blueprint. Small, play-based, highly responsive. This is what's creating the demand.
Right.
Now we have to pivot and confront the supply-side challenge, the brutal financial and regulatory realities that make this model so incredibly hard to actually run.
This is where the dream meets the spreadsheet. And when you move from research theory to actual practice, you immediately crash into what we call the impossible triangle.
The impossible triangle. Okay, lay it out for us. What are the 3 points that you can't achieve all at once?
Okay, you cannot simultaneously achieve 1, affordable tuition for a middle-class family.
Right, say under 8 grand a year.
2, living wages for teachers with benefits.
A basic necessity.
And 3, financial sustainability for the school itself, meaning you're not going to go bankrupt mid-year. The basic laws of economics make it impossible to hit all 3 without some kind of external support.
Let's ground this with some real numbers. For a high-quality program, let's say 15 students, what are we looking at for annual costs?
So assuming a lean model, maybe not in a fancy commercial space, Our analysis shows your total annual costs are going to be between about $158,500 and $190,500.
Okay, so if you divide that by 15 students, just to break even,
you're immediately looking at tuition of $10,567 to $12,700 per student.
And that's for the lean model.
That's for the lean model. If you want a premium program, commercial space, full benefits, credentialed staff, that costs jumps to between $17,800 and $23,800 per student.
Which puts you in direct competition with high-end accredited private schools.
Yeah.
It kind of defeats the purpose for a lot of families.
It does. And the heart of the problem is the fixed cost burden.
Right. Costs that you have to pay whether you have five kids or 15.
Exactly. The biggest one after salary is your facility. But right behind that is commercial insurance. Liability insurance for a school can run from $12,000 to $36,000 a year.
And your first few students are carrying that whole cost.
Your first five students are bearing a huge, disproportionate amount of that burden. The unit economics are terrible at the start, which is why the break-even point is so high.
Typically where? 8 to 10 kids?
For a lean home-based model, yeah, 8 to 10. For a leased space, you need more like 12 to 15 students just to survive.
But what's so fascinating is that founders are finding ways to solve this triangle. Usually through strategic trade-offs. The research points to four distinct business models that seem to be working.
That's the key. It's always a strategic sacrifice.
So model one, home-based plus lean operations. This goes right after the biggest expense.
A facility. Leasing a commercial space can cost $60,000 to $120,000 a year. If you operate from home, that cost drops to basically zero. That's the only way you get tuition down into that $6,000 to $8,000 range.
And we're seeing policy actually start to enable this, like with that new law in Utah.
Utah is leading the way. Their SB 13 bill from 2024 defines home-based microschools with 16 or fewer students as a permitted use in all residential zoning districts.
So you can't be shut down by your local zoning board anymore.
Exactly. It preempts those local restrictions and solves the facility problem for founders in that state.
Okay. Model two. Cooperative structures. This one substitutes parent labor for staff wages.
This relies on deep parent buy-in. Parents have to take on real responsibilities, supervision, cleaning, admin tasks. By doing that, you can cut your staffing costs by 50 to 67%.
And that gets tuition down into that truly affordable range, like $4,000 to $8,000 a year.
It does. But the trade-off is pretty obvious.
Quality.
Yeah.
Consistency.
Right. It can vary wildly. And we know from industry data that a pretty shocking 13% of microschools track no academic progress whatsoever. That risk is probably concentrated in these isolated co-op models.
Model three is the network-supported model. This solves the founder burnout problem.
It does. The network provides the back-end infrastructure. They handle payroll, insurance, compliance, marketing. It lets the founder focus on teaching.
What are some examples of how those networks work financially?
Sure. Prenda charges a platform fee of about $2,200 per student per year. Wildflower, which is for Montessori schools, charges about $10,000 a year, but offers startup grants and loans.
And they have a good track record.
A perfect track record. They've loaned over $5 million to 49 schools with zero defaults, which tells you their support model is incredibly effective at ensuring these schools survive.
And finally, Model 4, which is the fastest growing, the ESA-funded model, the public subsidy.
Right. This tackles affordability directly. About 32% of microschools now take state choice funds, mostly through education savings accounts or ESAs.
And those amounts can be significant.
They can be. Arkansas gives about $600, $800 per student. Texas's new program will offer $10,800.
$10,000. That instantly solves the tuition puzzle for a lean, home-based program.
Instantly. Prenda reports that 99% of its students use ESA funding, making the program basically free for families. But there's a trade-off.
The strings attached.
The strings attached. ESAs require formalization, reporting, compliance, and you create policy risk. That funding can disappear with the next election.
Okay, so moving from money to the regulatory maze.
Yeah.
The core issue seems to be what you call the missing middle.
It is. Most states just don't have a legal category for a 10-student flexible education program. So they try to force you into one of three bad fits: private school, childcare center, or homeschool law.
And states are going in completely different directions with this. You've got the deregulation model, like Utah again.
Utah is trying to create a safe harbor by exempting small home-based programs from commercial building codes and zoning. They're removing the biggest friction points.
And then on the other end, you have the restrictive model.
Right, like Colorado. They often force private K programs into childcare licensing if they run more than a few hours a day.
Which triggers all these rules that don't make sense for a school, right? Like nap time rules and specific director credentials.
Exactly. Rules designed for infant care, not a K-1 program.
I think the most vivid example of this friction is the fire code bottleneck. This feels like the thing that just kills programs.
It is often the single most significant operational hurdle. The issue is classification. At a certain number of students, you get reclassified from a standard business to an educational occupancy.
And when that happens?
The local fire marshal comes in. And in some states, like the Florida example we found, inspectors have required commercial sprinkler systems that cost over $100,000 for a program with fewer than 20 kids.
$100,000. That is a death sentence for any of these lean business models.
It's an immediate deal breaker. The regulation, even if it's well-intentioned, basically acts as a barrier that only large, wealthy institutions can overcome.
And this creates a really clear incentive for schools to stay small, right? The threshold effect.
Maine is a perfect example. They have a category for a small childcare facility, which is 3 to 12 kids. You go to 13, you become a childcare center, and that triggers a mountain of new regulations.
So founders just cap enrollment at 12 to avoid the headache.
They do it all the time. They intentionally stay just below whatever that regulatory trigger is in their state.
So the operational reality is just a landmine. But let's circle back to what the research says matters for quality, no matter the model. What are the non-negotiables?
First, the physical environment. Quality kindergarten programs need 45 to 55 square feet of usable activity space per child.
So for a group of 10 to 15 kids, you need a pretty good sized room.
You need 450 to 825 square feet of dedicated space. And it needs to be organized.
Into clear learning zones.
Yes. Not just desks. You need a literacy corner, a math area, an art space, a dramatic play zone. And things like natural light and natural materials, they really do matter.
What about the daily schedule? What does an evidence-based kindergarten day look like?
It has to balance structure and play. The research-backed structure includes 30 to 45 minutes of free play, 45 minutes of explicit literacy and phonics instruction, 45 minutes for math, and at least 30 minutes of outdoor play.
But a lot of these macro schools run part-time. Can they still be effective?
They can be, but they have to be incredibly intentional. They need to maximize that in-person time by focusing on the highest impact things. Socialization, guided play, and targeted small group literacy and math work.
Okay, this evidence-spanning development, finance, and regulation, it really gives us a map. Let's move into the final section, application. How do we act on this knowledge?
For founders, the very first step is to accept the reality of the impossible triangle and pick one of those four paths. You can't move forward until you solve the money puzzle.
So let's run through those four frameworks again, focusing on the trade-offs.
Okay, if you're in an ESA state like Arizona or Texas, path one, home base plus network plus ESA is probably your best bet. It makes tuition affordable for families.
But you're trading financial pressure for policy risk.
High policy risk. If you're in a state without school choice, but you have a really committed community, then you're looking at path two. The cooperative structure.
You're substituting parent labor for salary costs.
Exactly. If you're in an affluent area, you could try path three, the premium model. But then you have to compete on quality with established private schools charging $20,000 or more.
And the most resilient path seems to be path four, the hybrid.
That's the hybrid network plus lean operations model. You're mixing funding streams, some tuition, some grants, maybe some ESA students. It's complex. But because you're not reliant on one single thing, it's often the most durable.
Once you have a financial path, then comes regulatory navigation. You need a tactical checklist for this.
Step one, classification. Check the compulsory attendance age in your state. If kindergarten is optional until age 6 or 7, which it is in 23 states, that gives you a lot more flexibility.
Step two, category. Choose your label wisely.
Yes. Your strategic goal is usually to be a private school or a homeschool co-op and to avoid being labeled a childcare center at all costs.
Because that triggers all those expensive, irrelevant rules about naps and playgrounds?
Yes.
Step three, the big one, zoning and facility.
You must consult the local fire marshal before you sign a lease. You need to get a written determination on how they classify educational occupancy for a program your size.
You have to get ahead of that $100,000 sprinkler problem.
It is the single most important action to prevent financial failure.
And finally, step four, ESA compliance, if you go that route.
You just have to be ready for the reporting. Public money means public accountability. That means tracking attendance, giving state-approved assessments, getting vendors approved. It's a real administrative burden.
Okay, on to quality. With 84% of these schools being unaccredited, internal accountability is everything.
It has to be ironclad. And it starts with measuring process quality, the thing we know matters most.
So how does a busy founder do that?
You implement observation-based feedback,
right.
Ideally using a validated tool like the Classroom Assessment Scoring System. It's designed specifically to evaluate the quality of teacher-child interactions.
So a founder or a mentor can use it to give concrete feedback.
Exactly. It moves the conversation from how was school to how effective were your high-level interactions today.
And what about tracking what the kids are actually learning?
Progress monitoring has to be systematic and transparent. This means student portfolios, developmental checklists, low-stakes assessments. This is the antidote to that 13% of schools who track nothing. You have to prove it's working.
And finally, to combat founder isolation,
you have to use network participation. Join a peer group, get a mentor. It reduces isolation, and it's the fastest way to learn about regulatory changes or new best practices.
Let's talk staffing strategy, especially with that credential paradox in mind. How should founders hire?
Since we know the four-year degree isn't a magic bullet, you have to focus on finding adults who are just naturally good at process quality.
So when does it make sense to hire someone without a traditional credential?
It can work really well when you're operating at very low ratios, like 8-to-1 or less, and when the founder themselves can provide strong in-house mentorship.
And when are credentials non-negotiable?
When you're serving disadvantaged populations, where the research shows the biggest benefits come from highly professional programs. And also if you're at higher ratios, like 1-to-12, where you really need that expertise in classroom management.
The sources suggest a mixed model can be a smart way to balance this.
It's a great strategy for sustainability. You pair a lead teacher who has a degree or strong certification with an uncredentialed assistant who is under their mentorship. You get the high process quality from the lead, but you contain your overall salary costs.
And founders have to be proactive about burnout.
You have to build solutions for it from day one. That means either delegating all the admin work to a network, or you implement a co-op structure where parents are contractually obligated to handle the non-teaching tasks.
Okay, now let's shift gears and give the checklist to the listener, to the parent who's thinking about enrolling their child in one of these schools. What are the key questions they must ask?
They have to move past the cute classroom and focus on the research-backed quality indicators. We've got 7 non-negotiable questions.
Question 1.
How exactly do you track my child's progress? If they say, oh, we just follow the child, that is a major red flag. They need a system, portfolios, checklists, something they can show you.
Question 2.
What is the lead teacher's background and ongoing training? Don't just ask about a degree. Ask about professional development, mentorship, network connections.
Question 3.
Walk me through a typical daily schedule. You're looking for that evidence-based balance, free play, structured phonics, math with manipulatives, and lots of outdoor time.
Question 4.
How do you handle different developmental levels? They have to be able to explain how they differentiate instruction for a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old in the same room.
Question 5, a tough one.
What is your financial sustainability plan? You need to know the program isn't going to fold in February. Ask if they have an operating reserve. Ask about their break-even enrollment number.
Question 6.
Are you accredited or working toward it? Most aren't. And that's okay, but asking shows you what their long-term commitment to quality is.
And 7.
How do you connect with other professionals for peer support? This gets at that isolation issue. An isolated founder is a high-risk founder.
Let's summarize that into clear green flags and red flags.
Green flags are systematic progress monitoring, network participation, transparency about what they're doing, and a visible plan for financial sustainability.
And red flags.
The biggest one is no progress tracking at all. That's a deal breaker. Also, founder isolation, being vague about curriculum or visible financial instability like high staff turnover.
So let's end with an honest assessment here. What is the massive promise and what is the profound risk?
The promise is completely rooted in developmental science. Small groups allow for responsiveness. Low ratios enable that high process quality that we know builds brains. Flexibility allows for extensive high-impact play.
But the risk is equally profound.
It is. Quality varies enormously with no external accountability. The financial fragility is real, and failures can leave families scrambling. And that 13% of schools tracking no progress are, frankly, gambling with a child's future.
So ultimately, the entire micro school kindergarten model is, for the 1 to 2 million kids in it, a massive ongoing experiment.
It is. And the only responsible path forward requires what I'd call epistemic humility coupled with operational excellence. We have to admit what we don't know, but act decisively on the proxy research we do have.
And implement our own quality controls.
We have to implement ironclad internal quality monitoring where the external systems are absent.
The foundational question, the bet we're making, still remains.
Exactly. We won't really know if this bet pays off until rigorous long-term research follows these kids through elementary school and beyond. The responsible path right now is to borrow from the research, be honest about the gaps, and participate in the evaluation this sector so urgently needs.
A massive thank you for walking us through the impossible triangle and the regulatory maze, and for giving our listeners that tactical checklist they need.
Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me. That's YUDA.ME.